All right, guys, what a pleasure have I got for you today? I don't know if the internet can handle so much fabulousness. I don't know if the zeros and ones can capture all the good looks that are taking place right now,
Oh,
but
stop it.
I've
Stop
got
it.
Milo Yiannopoulos with us right here. How you doing, Milo?
I'm very well. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, thank you for being on. So I thought what we would do today, I mean, there are so many things that we'd like to cover, and a lot of people have written in to say, oh, please ask him about this and so on. So I thought what we'd start with is sort of go over some of the key folks that you typically criticize and then see if there is any, I mean, is there a theme in terms of the typical targets that you go after? Is it that you're going after shoddy reasoning and so on? So I thought we would start with maybe the most recent thing that you've put out, which is a critique of our good friend, Mr. Science Guy, Mr. Bowtie. I was about to wear a bow tie, by the way, for you and
Oh,
didn't
well, I
because
don't
I.
even own one, I don't think. I have one for my black tie. I don't think I have a regular bow tie because, of
There
course, nobody wears them because they're ridiculous.
So why don't we start with Dan? I think we could then tie it. You had, as part of that series, you also critiqued Tyson and other sort of
Indeed.
communicative science. So why don't we start with that and then we can see where it goes.
Sure thing. So, I mean, one of the things that always entertains me about people in the public eye professing to explain science or explain any discipline are the sorts of political forces that begin to act on them when they enter the public sphere, when they get purchased in the media, when they get a book deal or a TV show, and particularly when they start to make friends. When they start to make friends who expect them to have a certain set of opinions and also expect them to communicate their ideas in particular language. And I discovered that, in particular, scientists have a problem with this. And they have a problem when they enter into the public arena and start off as perfectly, in some cases, perfectly respectable communicators and researchers of whether it's astrophysics or engineering or whatever. Once they start to get very popular, they seem to all cleave in one political direction, and it's a political, and it's a, to a sort of a sort of 10 commandments of progressive liberalism that is quite often not entirely in keeping with the scientific method, very often not at all in keeping with basic sort of principles of academic integrity, and sort of entertainingly homogenous in the way, in the place that all these people end up in order to survive. And it tells you something interesting about the biases in the media when a scientist can't really be a very popular scientist unless he signs up to a particular board of sort of a chalkboard of ideas. So I for the series that I do at Breitbart, there's only two episodes so far. I say episodes, I mean columns. It's a written series. Scientists who are actually really stupid, and the first installment was Neil deGrasse Tyson, who I think is you know I always thought he was the best example of this, but then everyone was saying, no, you should have started with Bill Nye. So I've done Bill Nye as well, and I know that you will probably have some things to say about him.
Yes.
but yeah, and I intend to continue this series and investigate the what these people all have in common is this sort of I won't go as far as, is it a selling out? I suppose it is. It's a sort of compromise of what you would usually consider to be principles of open-minded scientific inquiry and free exchange of ideas.
Right.
When they start to become famous, they start to use language like, you have to believe this or else, in the
Right,
case
right.
of Bill Nye. Or in the case of Neil deGrasse Tyson, he starts ridiculing and demeaning his ideological opponents, which
Right,
is, you
right.
know, for somebody who is supposed to be a sort of flagship figure in culture for the open exchange of ideas and for the scientific inquiry, for open inquiry into the world around us, for the sort of humility and open-mindedness that we, I think, expect from our scientific figureheads and from science. It sort of leaves, I think it leaves the public wondering, well, if these are the guys that are famous, how much worse are the guys in universities?
So let me interject. I mean, you mentioned a word that I very much like, and humility, right? So there's this idea of epistemological humility. I think Peter Boghossian, a friend of mine, a philosopher, mentioned it recently in our conversation. But it's an idea that goes back to, I think, Confucius, right? The idea of knowing what you know and what you don't know, and that's ultimately knowledge, right? So real practicing scientists are actually incredibly, they're filled with doubt, right? Because they are absolutely aware, they're calibrated about the things that they know. And when they know something, they know the boundary conditions that allows them to say, this is true, but that's the boundary to which I'm willing to go in terms of supporting that idea. So they're actually quite humble in terms of their epistemological outlook. I think what happens with guys like Tyson and the science guy, by the way, the science guy, not to denigrate him, he's not a scientist, right? I mean, he's a guy who popularized science, right? And that's great. I mean, he does a wonderful job at it. But I think what happens is that they succumb to a lack of epistemological humility because they get so much attention, so they no longer can calibrate what they know and what they don't know. What do you think of that?
I think it's probably true, and certainly the scientists that I know, whether it's researchers, the people who are actively in universities, they very often talk about just how radically unsound scientific knowledge can be sometimes. They took the half-life of facts, things that we thought we knew just half a decade ago, aren't true anymore. There are huge changes in our understanding of the way that the world around us works, so the way that different elements in that world interact with one another, and our basic understanding of matter and physics there are all sorts of things that we thought we knew 10 years ago that aren't true anymore. And it's that sort of, it's the arrogance and certainty and dismissiveness. And sometimes it can come across as sort of almost bullying, patronizing smugness from these people, which to me seems profoundly antithetical to the whole purpose of doing science and doing any kind of study, actually. Right. Trying to find out what you don't know is the whole reason that anybody interested in letters or numbers or, processes or anything in the world around us is engaged in. That's what we're trying to do. We're trying to find out the most information we can, synthesize it through a variety of different, with a variety of different sort of methods of interrogation, look at it through a few different prisms and lenses to see if that throws up any more, illuminating insights, and then try to come to some kind of happy, temporary coalition between the various different data. This is not what famous public scientists, like public intellectuals, do, because their media career relies on them oversimplifying to the point of parody, and to a great degree, their professional success and their financial success relies on them having the right opinions.
Right.
Because if they don't have the right opinions about things, they don't get books commissioned and they don't get TV series. And all of these things, these are some of the reasons why, I think these guys, they're rich, famous, successful celebrities. I think they can cope with a bit of teasing, and I think they can cope with a bit of questioning from someone like me, because they deserve to have, they deserve to be reminded, I think, that intellectual humility is the cornerstone of any sincere intellectual inquiry and any discussion of, with any integrity or sincerity or any claim to seriousness.
Right.
That intellectual humility has got to be the cornerstone. It's got to be the foundation on which everything else is built, and they don't have it.
Yeah, I hear you. You mentioned that you characterized them as celebrities. There's actually, you may not know this, there's a bibliometric measure that's come out called the Kardashian Index. Are you familiar with it?
No, I don't. This sounds amazing.
So the Kardashian Index is actually a measure of a scientist's, influence in academia, as a ratio or in relation to his fame in terms of his public outreach. So, of course, the ideal guy would be one who has the public outreach of Tyson, but also has the, the scientific influence of, right? Now, of course, what happens with someone like Tyson, he actually scores extraordinarily, right? He does absolutely no science, but he, of course, is profoundly famous. And so I think the sweet spot is to always have your foot in the door of science.
So who's an example of somebody who gets it right? Would that be perhaps Stephen Hawking?
Stephen Hawking, perhaps.
Maybe that's a better balance.
I mean, Richard Dawkins is no longer doing much science. Certainly, I don't think in the last 15 years or so.
Maybe 20 years.
Exactly. 20 yep. years ago, if we had Twitter and these types of social metric measures, I think he would have been somebody who was practicing, who was doing, serious science, and who was doing outreach. So the second thing I want to mention, to go back to Bill Nye, I mean, the reason why I sort of took him on, you know, it's not, you know, I never attack the person. My goal is not to sort of troll him. I don't know Bill Nye. I'm sure that he's a lovely guy. There's actually a get together in California in a few weeks where I was potentially going to be heading to, but it doesn't fit my schedule, where he would have been there. And so I received an email from someone saying, hey, heads up, you might have to meet Bill Nye face to face. But in any case, the reason why I went after him is because when he, I didn't really know much about him until I saw him on a HuffPost live interview, where he came up with just a hallucinatory, delusional causal explanation for how the Paris terrorist attack, and more generally the strife in the Middle East, is linked to climate change.
Oh God!
Right?
Oh God!
And you should see how some of these climate trolls came after me, because what they were thinking, what they thought I was saying, is that I was questioning, whether climate change is happening or not. And that's not right. But, you know, when it comes to Occam's razor and how parsimonious an explanation is for a given phenomenon,
you've got to go some, haven't you?
I mean, the drought is not really the main thing that served as the multiplier effect in the Middle East. So that to me is problematic, because you put out such a narrative, and then you get a bunch of folks who buy into that narrative, and then it becomes it if you like, it clouds the real mechanisms at play, which deal with religion and totalitarian ideology and so on. So that's why I got upset, right? It wasn't because, you know, I'm not busy enough in my day that I feel like just trolling Bill Nye, right?
So. You got nothing better to do.
Exactly.
But this is, so as a journalist, we, you know, part of our job is looking for patterns and spotting trends. And when I see somebody who is supposedly a sort of neutral popularizer of science and the scientific method echoing comments that sound crazy to me, that I've heard in the mouth of, say, Bernie Sanders,
right,
whom I do not take terrifically seriously on geopolitical issues.
Right.
And these two people are both saying the same thing. And I'm thinking, well, this scientist has sort of got form on this, you know, of sort of having the correct received opinions. And they're both saying it in the same way with the, you know, both seemingly wanting to get at the same people. Look at the sort of ideological overtones, the sort of look at the red threads that run through a lot of Neil deGrasse Tyson's most provocative public statements. And you'll find that many of them are directed at humiliating and ridiculing social conservatives,
right,
ridiculing Republicans. You know, his famous Christmas Day tweet was it, you know, sort of like, today we celebrate the birth of somebody who changed the world. Newton. Except no, he was born in January. You know, he can't.
Is that true, actually? Is he
well,
wrong?
You adjust for the calendar. Yeah, okay. I mean, he was born in January. You know, he can't even get the basic facts on his, on his smarmy, snide, smug, you know, unpleasant ridicule, you know, and it's like, I kind of understand, because I too, as a journalist, being a little bit, I can occasionally be tone deaf to feel, I'm very against the sort of social justice brigade, all of their sort of grievance mongering and victimhood politics. I don't have much truck with offense taking. So I can sometimes be a little tone deaf, you know. I can sometimes say things, you know, as anyone who follows my Twitter feed.
No.
I know, it's hard to believe, right? But I can occasionally come out with things that some people may find offensive or insensitive, or perhaps too soon, as they say. But it takes a special kind of, and I can't use any of the words I want to use with you, but it's a special kind of schmuck, let's go with that, to come out on Christmas
You're
Day.
You're appropriating a Jewish word, by the way. That's racist.
No, I'm a member of the family, darling.
Oh, that's true. Now, how come your mother is Jewish and you consider yourself Roman Catholic? How did that happen?
Well, because my grandmother brought me up Catholic.
Ah, gotcha, okay.
So yeah, so it's okay, we're fine. No cultural appropriation here. I lost my thread. No, it takes a special sort of schmuck to, like, on Christmas Day, just decide that of all of the things that are going on in your life that day, right, one of your parents are mine, and have a go at Christians on, right, Christmas Day, or whenever, close to Christmas Day, right, you know. And I just thought, something is going on here, and what's going on here is not the neutral, entertaining popularization of science.
Right. Let's go after maybe your bête noire, your top nemesis, even more than Tyson and Nye.
I don't even know what that is.
Feminist, no? Let's talk about feminists.
But my God.
But before you do that, let me sort of mention to you, some of my own trials and tribulations with this general topic. So as you may or may not know, I apply evolutionary psychology in the behavioral sciences, and specifically in consumer behavior. And of course, as a evolutionary psychologist, one of the things that, of course, I take for granted, as any sane person would, is that there are evolved sex differences between the two sexes. As a matter of fact, Homo sapiens are defined as a sexually dimorphic species, meaning that there are built-in differences between the two sexes. Now, you may or may not know this, but within the social sciences, this has historically been a profoundly heretical statement, right?
Yeah.
Everything short of your genitalia is a social construction, and therefore to propose that anything is due to some biological imperative is outlandish to them. And so that discussion in terms of coming against feminists is not something that only I've engaged in terms of on Twitter and in public forums, but also in my scientific work, I've had to come across oftentimes people who were very hostile to biology in general and to biology as applied to sex differences. So that's, in a sense, that's why I'm particularly, drawn to the discussion dealing with feminism. But in your case, what is it that served as the catalyst for you to go after them? Is it just that you don't like their BS and you're looking for truth? Or what is compelling you to go after them?
Well, I always find it entertaining, and as a journalist, we're always sort of ferreting. Our job as journalists is to sort of ferret around the fibs and the PR and the marketing and get to what's actually going on. And it struck me that feminism was a good example of this in action. It was remarkable to me. I mean, it sort of piques my interest when I see people denying obvious facts, in service of a greater good. Whether it's the narrative over fact approach to campus rape culture, in Rolling Stone, and all of the fake rape cases that publications either didn't look into closely enough because they didn't want to, or didn't look into close, or did look into closely enough and published anyway. Now, that seems to me a subject of something really systemically wrong. It's gone wrong. And as a journalist, I didn't come to it with a discipline that is sort of butting up against feminist academics in my work life as you did. But I've come to it from the point of view of a journalist whose purpose is to speak truth to power. And it's very clear that the most powerful social movement, the most powerful political philosophy of our time is feminism. Now, the problem is the particular brand of feminism is poisonous. The one that occupies, the seats of power in academia and the media and even in politics is a force for ill in the world, in my view. Now, feminism, to be clear, I call myself a second wave feminist. I would never identify as a feminist these days because I think the term is ruined, as all but 7% of British women and 18% of American women now agree, who don't identify as feminists because they see what we see, that these people are crazy. I would call myself a second wave feminist. I believe in equality of access and opportunity for everyone. I think everyone should have a level playing field, equal education, equal access to the institutions that surround us, and should be rewarded equally for their efforts, their talents, and their enthusiasm. That's not what modern feminism believes.
Right.
And modern feminism has become, I think, well, in the words of Christina Hoff Sommers, who I think put it best and put it most delicately, a sort of female chauvinism. It now seems to be principally concerned with hating men.
Right.
The sort of awful sociopathic hashtags that, kill all white men and, I'm drinking male tears. I mean, imagine substituting any other sexual ethnic group into here, and you begin to see just how ugly this stuff is. And it isn't really about reasserting, anything on behalf of womanhood. It's just, in my view, it's just about hating men. And in order to do that, I think in order to paint women as some sort of superior sex, you have to deny basic biological reality.
Right.
You have to deny all sorts of things, actually, which are self-evidently obvious to any sensible person. And you also have to have a particularly sort of, these days it seems, certainly looking at any of the feminists in the media and in academia, you have to have you have to be a sociopath, because to look at the facts as they are out there in the world today in the West, let's be specific, and to claim that women are an oppressed class of person in the UK or the US is plainly insane. I mean, it just bears no reality whatsoever. In fact, what much of the data suggests is that the opposite is true, and that men are suffering. And just very briefly, I'll try and wrap up because I've touched on this. The final thing that I really strongly object to, well, not the final thing, another thing I hate about feminism is it is profoundly anti-intellectual, as I suggested earlier, but also it has a loathing for free speech. Right. It has a loathing for open, honest debate. It is a, like the scientists I dislike, or the popularizers of science I dislike, it is a smug, sociopathic creed of dead dogma.
So go ahead. Finish your point.
No, I'm done. I'll be going forever otherwise.
So two things I want to say. First, I don't know if you saw, I put up a YouTube clip a while ago where I was summarizing some findings on sex differences in educational attainment in the United States. And so what this data looks at is four levels of university degrees, what the US calls associate degrees, which is the equivalent of about half a bachelor's. So associate degree, bachelor's degree, master's, and doctorate. So four levels of degrees. And then across five racial groups. So you basically had 20 cells, four levels of education by five races, to look at within each of these cells, which of the two sexes was being granted the greater number of degrees. Guess out of the 20 cells, how many men were greater than women?
Any?
Zero, exactly. None. And so I facetiously said that, yes, there is rampant sexism in American universities. Of course, people would click on that thinking that it would be the usual narrative. It's the exact opposite.
Yeah, it's like, actually, no.
Now, the other thing I was going to mention is that I recently had three very, very unpleasant exchanges with the types of folks that you're describing, two of whom were, I don't know what it is about Forbes journalists, they're drinking something in the water, but these were two Forbes women whom I had interacted with very briefly on Twitter. And it truly politely, I mean, it wasn't at all, it didn't have any sting, and the mere fact that they were being questioned turned into cyberbullying, and then right? And
that's an amazing thing they do. Sorry, you finish first.
Yeah, hold on. Now, of course, what I did is a strategy that I saw that you do in your own way, which is in your case, you call on your sexual orientation to protect you from your
What an allegation! What an allegation!
In my case, I call upon. I'm from Lebanon, brown man, I'm Jewish, I am overweight, and so I tack on all of the...
You've got a good oppression package there.
A good oppression package, and so they literally are afraid to engage me because they don't... So then I start saying things like, look at this white privileged woman attacking the fat brown man, and boom, they disappear. So actually, they don't debate me on the content. We literally have an oppressions Olympic contest. Yep. I win, they go away. But the other point, the other one I want to mention was this woman put up. You can go check out her site. She's a woman who's trying to set up this new law in the United States called rape by fraud. Are you familiar with this idea?
Oh my God! I can see where this is going.
Okay, and I actually put up a clip, and she came after me, saying that I was defaming her. So criticizing a public idea was libelous. So basically, she argued that when men and women are interacting with one another, if a man in the service of trying to bed a woman is duplicitous to her. And then beds her.
Misrepresents his net worth or something. Yeah.
Whatever, right? Then that is rape by fraud that should be punishable by up to 20 years in prison. So
people are insane.
I did a YouTube clip where I sort of, without trying to even mention her, I mean, I had to point to her website because I have to demonstrate the actual reference. But I said, how crazy is it? Because, 90% of online daters, both men and women, would be in prison for rape because women will lie about their age, about their looks, about their weight, about this. Guys will
any
lie.
Woman in a push-up bra.
Exactly. About the guy lies about his height, his income, his ambition. So, I mean, everybody is a rapist. But, of course, she came after me and said, you're going to hear from my lawyer because you're defaming me. So it's lunacy.
So, I mean, the two things there that you mentioned that I'll pick up on. One is the supremacy of identity politics over any sort of substantive argument. The idea that your worth in debate, and worse than that, the quality of your ideas is determined by your skin color. I find that so fundamentally abhorrent. Like, that's genuinely offensive.
Right.
That is actually offensive. That offends my, you know, my intellect. It offends my sense of fairness. It offends everything. Like, that's genuinely offensive. You know, the fact that I, you know, the quality of my ideas and my work, that, you know, would be judged, would be, you know, dismissed or unduly promoted, either of the two, according to my skin color, my sexuality, or my gender. Insane. The other thing is, I don't want to cast aspersions on this woman in particular, so we'll speak about this in general terms,
sure,
but very often I've noticed with these sort of particularly batty social justice warriors, and I've reported on some of these in the past, you know, people, the Shanley Kanes of this world, who's a prominent Silicon Valley feminist, the Randy Harpers, who, you know, is responsible for appalling abuses and yet sets herself up as a sort of anti-harassment champion. There's this incredible cognitive dissonance they have going on. Very often you'll discover deep dysfunction in their private lives. And my guess is that very often the business of engaging in social justice, of bullying other people, of the, engaging in oppression Olympics, is quite often a sort of it's a sort of therapy,
right,
for people, right, who are suffering. It's a sort of learned response to trauma, because after a while you realize that so many of the ringleaders in this incredibly off the wall movement have such checkered, dark, you know, ugly pasts of lies, drug taking.
How do you get access to that information?
Well, very often you see, of course, because they're attention seekers and because they are desperate for affirmation and to play and for victimhood bucks, you know, for the they want currency of victimhood. Most of the time, they publish this stuff about themselves. I've only ever written this stuff according to, you know, the Randy Harper thing. Everything I've ever written about Randy Harper is stuff she published on the internet about herself, and then later tried to cover over when it didn't fit her latest sort of twist and turn, and you know, in her sort of endless quest to be accepted by someone, anyone, you know. The problem with all of this is I don't feel any animosity toward people who are suffering and looking for a solution, but I do feel a responsibility as a journalist to, you know, to sort of cut off some of these people's influence if I can, when they are unduly affecting innocent people. And in the case of, you know, some of the feminists I was involved in the Gamergate controversy, or whether it is other you know, deeply hypocritical, damaged people whose life mission seems to be to make others suffer on the flimsiest of pretexts and with no, you know, and with the most insane, absurd arguments, arguments that are making their way up into the highest corridors of power, right, in the West, right? That's how worrying this stuff is.
You're thinking about Obama with his rape campus.
Obama with the rape stuff, or Black Lives Matter, you know, like getting Bernie Sanders off stage and calling a halt to his campaigns. You know, there's a particular kind of damage in the millennial generation that I don't think we had as Gen, what am I, Gen X, I guess, yeah. You know, we didn't have this. We had Nirvana, Marilyn Manson, and, you know, self-harm, and we got it out of our systems. But the millennials didn't. They didn't get this out of their systems. It's what I think is the first fully middle-class generation, right, who've never really suffered. They've never really known damage. And so every slight perceived insult becomes a sort of catastrophic trauma that they need to then revisit back on the world. In the emo, you know, the emo kids of the 90s who would sit in their rooms and cry and take drugs and cut themselves and listen to Marilyn Manson would at least get it out of their systems and turn it inward, you know, and it wouldn't affect other people. But the millennials are doing something different. They're taking that teen trauma, they're dragging it out into their 20s and 30s and visiting it upon the rest of the world. And it's because I'm kind of on the cusp of both of those generations. I sort of understand the impulses and have a lot of friends in both camps. And I have to say, I mean, the millennials are just the most broken generation in history. You know, so the way they treat others is just awful.
And let me add to that. I want to add to that. And it's something I think there's a big echo, by the way. Is there something on your end? There's a massive echo happening.
I can see if I can find a pair of something.
I think I'm going to try to speak. Let's keep going, but maybe if you don't move, because I think you're hitting something.
Hold that.
All right. All right, guys, we have some dead time. You can get to watch me look at the camera. For those of you who think that I blink a lot, it's because I look at the camera and that hurts my eyes. Oh, here you are.
I am. I've come back with a solution.
I was trying to explain to people while you were gone, because some people write on my comments section that I blink a lot. And the reason that I blink a lot, it's because I have to stare at this damn green dot and it hurts my eyes and I end up blinking a lot.
Yeah, me too. I actually have I have lots of different eye conditions and lots of different eye problems.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, and I find it very difficult to look at one spot.
Exactly,
so I fidget a lot and I look around a lot and everyone thinks I'm on cocaine, but I'm not. Earlier stage in my life.
If you're using now the headphones, it shouldn't affect, and it's still recording properly, right? I mean, let's hope so.
We're going to be fine.
All right. So here's my theory to add to some of the mechanisms that you were talking about in terms of social justice warriors. So there's this psychiatric disorder known as Munchausen syndrome.
Yeah.
Right? And there's also Munchausen syndrome by proxy. So Munchausen syndrome is where I desire so much to gain sympathy and empathy and people to pay attention to me that I feign illness so that then the doctors and my family and my friends can say, oh, poor Linda.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And then, of course, by proxy, it's where you take somebody who's in your care, your pet.
Yeah, like the child.
Your child, you know, and
child
you do it
has,
to them.
You lie. It's these women who lie that their kids have cancer, that kind of thing.
Exactly. And so I think maybe for some of these social justice warriors, there is an opportunity to gain a lot of attention and sympathy if you constantly cry victimhood, right?
Yes,
you get the white knights to come to protect you and so on. So I think there's definitely that element that's taking place also.
It's interesting. We seem to have not just started to permit this, but to actively encourage it by allowing victimhood to become a currency.
Right.
You know, it is victimhood is now social power.
Right.
If you can lay some claim to victim, you will the burden of proof on your statements lowers, your social standing and your earning potential increases in the modern sort of online Patreon, you know, fueled economy. You will get press, you will get attention, you will have legions of sycophantic, adoring, credulous idiots on the internet lapping up your every word. If you can only persuade yourself that you were some kind of victim, and it's interesting that you should seek to pathologize it as some kind of because I think you might be right when you look at the language these people use and which examples of victimhood they reach for. So you occasionally see girls sort of wrongly, you know, falsely claiming to have been raped. Now there's absolutely no way that anybody can know how common that is. It seems obvious from the number of prominent rape cases that turn out to be frauds, i.e. all of them, that it's certainly a problem on American campuses at the moment. But it's impossible to get, you know, there's just no numbers on this. There's no way even to find out what the numbers might be. So let's put that aside and let's consider, you know, the way in which social justice warriors articulate their dissatisfaction with the world and the way that they interrogate dissent and disagreement. Well, first of all, they give themselves syndromes and problems. They say that they are gender fluid and they give themselves all sorts of muddied sexual identities.
Right.
They constantly talk about being depressed or having trauma or stress. You know, they say that they've been crying and the shaking and crying language, you know, all of this stuff, you know, can sound very, very much like sort of diagnostic criteria for one of these hysterical illnesses. And then if you look at the way that they respond to criticism, they like to mischaracterize ridicule and criticism, which are essential and important tools in our rhetorical arsenal.
You're attacking.
As bullying.
Yeah.
As abuse, harassment, threats, and victimhood. What is that? That's called paranoia and persecution complex.
Right.
You know. So it's interesting. I kind of have semi-thought it, but never really never really brought it fully out like you just did. I sort of semi-identified the kind of slightly pathological nature of a lot of this behavior. But I think you're right. And I think it's worrying if we've encouraged, I think we know that people are malleable and people, you know, want to get, people will get what they can get, you know, and if you tell kids that they can get away with something, they'll push it 10% over that. If you hand people a victimhood script and you tell them that this is the route to riches, to power, to fame, to notoriety, to social affirmation, which is, you know, an important currency, you know, they're going to take it, they're going to use it, they're going to follow the path. And what we've done, what the media has done, I think, over the last 5 or 10 years, is tell people that they have only to claim that they're victims in order to receive...
Get on Oprah.
Exactly.
Right.
You know, to get on Oprah. And in fact, it goes, when you put it like that, it goes a lot further than 10 years. This has been building for a generation or two.
You know, there's something that I could use from sort of my personal history to combat some of those impulses that these SJWs have. And that is my personal history, right? So for someone who, you know, I don't know if you know my story, but we escaped Lebanon during the Civil War as Lebanese Jews under, you know, imminent threat of death. My parents then 4 years later in 1980, we left at the end of 75. In 1980, they had gone back to Lebanon. They were kidnapped and some really bad things happened. And so somebody who's gone through, I mean, what you see in the news every day is stuff that, you know, I grew up with and I escaped from, right? So it becomes very difficult for the Wellesley ladies to cry victimhood when I come in and I say, oh, you want to talk about victimhood because you don't fit into your pants anymore? Yeah. Here's a story of victimhood.
Melody Wellesley, before you carry on.
The reason why I mentioned Wellesley, by the way, is because I actually was invited to go there into the hornet's nest to speak about how the thought police regulate the free exchange of ideas. And
That must have gone nicely.
Actually, it was pretty good because I think I'm not really one that sends out the cues that you could intimidate me into a fetal position. So they were quite...
You don't. You're quite an alpha, aren't you? That's a little alpha in you. I can see it.
A little? But I wanted to move on to something else. Another battle that I've been seeing you're having. Well, there are two battles. There's the Twitter battle in general against Twitter. But I thought we would discuss, and I don't know how long you want to spend on this, but it had great comedic value, your ongoing back and forth with Ben Shapiro. How did you two?
I love Ben Shapiro so much.
For those of you who don't know, Ben Shapiro is a sort of conservative Jewish guy in, I think, out of Southern California, who maybe became most famous for his defense of the Second Amendment when he went up against Piers Morgan. And I think he really did hold his own against Piers. And that's pretty much the extent of what I knew about Ben, and we had communicated maybe once or twice, him and I. And then I see on my Twitter feed Milo and Ben going at each other, and I was literally cracking up laughing at both of your retorts. I mean, you were both on. So what is going on there? What happened? Tell us about the feud.
We love each other.
Are you being serious now? Like, do you genuinely...
Yes. Okay. So lots of people ask me this. Okay. And it is... We're DMing each other saying this is great, isn't it? At the same time as we're hurling like invective at each other. But it's... I think you can see that we do it with love. Yes. It's in a very... you know, he'll take the mickey out of me for being a, you know, promiscuous homosexual, and I'll take the mickey out of him for being short and having like very old readership, you know. And I'll say the difference. You don't want to know the difference between me and Ben Shapiro? You know, my readers will still be alive in 5 years. You know, like all this kind of stuff. And he'll say something like, "What's the?" What has Miley Yiannopoulos got in common with a chocolate fountain? Like, everybody gets a taste. You know, whatever. Anyway, so we have a very fun, lively kind of professional rivalry.
But what started it? How did it, I mean, you don't seem to be running in the same circle.
We're both we're probably the two best known writers for Breitbart News.
Oh,
so we have that in common, and we kind of know each other from that. We've been on stage once or twice before. Obviously my profile, I think we're both self-confident people. We're both, I don't want to call him, I'm certainly arrogant and egotistical and self-important and self-involved. I wouldn't call it Ben any of those things, but he has an appropriate pride for his professional accomplishments, you know? So obviously my profile in America has risen very quickly. And Ben is always used to having been the wunderkind, you know? He's the one who was like playing the violin at age 12 for, you know, the ambassador of whatever. You know, he was always like the amazing kind of prodigy. And then sort of coming up, bringing up the rear, as he might put it, is this sort of upstart Brit who's suddenly kind of like catching him up in Twitter followers and readership and all the rest of it. So we have a very affectionate, healthy sparring between the two of us. I have overtaken him in Twitter followers, incidentally. a very healthy, lovely, affectionate sparring, which sort of flares up once in a while. And once in a while, we'll just be sitting there for 2 hours just sort of throwing quips. You know what I like about it? And as you know, I hate to flatter myself, but
yes.
Obviously, beyond what's obviously unavoidable. What I like about it is you very rarely see these days kind of affectionate rivalries between prominent writers that are played out in letters. You know, I think up until maybe 20, 30 years ago, there was a good sort of healthy tradition of writers and thinkers and media figures and academics and sort of corresponding and having interesting public relationships, you know.
Yeah.
And one of my favorite things to do is read sort of collected letters between, you know, great poets or journalists or whatever, the great sort of literary and political and journalistic rivalries of history are very interesting. And we don't really have anything like that, and I don't know of anything truly interesting in that bracket, you know, in that sort of genre, as it were, in the last sort of 10, 20 years. And I think Ben and I hope people enjoy what we do, because I like to imagine that we're recapturing some of that spirit.
What I liked about it is that while you were trading insults, I think one could read the under sort of lying friendliness, actually, right? And I think that's the difference between sort of goading one another, but you know that deep down, I mean, as you correctly said, I mean, and I think I picked that up, that there seemed to be some affection there, like, right? Neither of you were getting upset. Whereas, you know, very, very rarely, I mean, I would say 99% of the time, you know, all of my exchanges with folks are always positive. But in the few occasions where somebody breaks a social violation, is disrespectful in a way that really annoys me, then even though to you it might sound like it was little, if I find it very disrespectful, I will respond harshly. And in seeing you two guys, you know, spar with one another, I didn't pick up any of that disrespect.
But you don't know, and I don't think there is any, because we have a profound respect for each other's different methods, you know? And it's one of the things that's good about not to make it too sort of left versus right, because I can get very boring very quickly, but I think there is a general humorlessness and earnestness on the political left. That, you know, it feeds into their language policing and their pronoun, like
Z.
Oh God! I mean, it's really is a pathology. You know, there's sort of it's this obsession with pronouns. All of that sort of the authoritarian instinct of the left, and it's not unique to the left. The religious right were just as bad in their own way,
right.
But. Were, you know, now today it's the left doing it. And I think there's a better tradition, although I think this is true in all periods of history, frankly, there's a better tradition of mischief and fun and irreverence and ridicule on the sort of libertarian dissident right, you know, whether it's Buckley or whatever, you know,
yes.
That sort of mischief and naughtiness, which is very much how I see myself.
You know
seeing that played out is nice. And Shapiro and I enjoy that with one another. So yeah, it's a fun thing for me.
I don't know if you know. Do you know who Bill Whittle is?
Do I know Bill Whittle?
Bill Whittle.
I feel like I recognize the name, but my knowledge of American figures is something.
So he's in. I mean, he releases a lot of his stuff through PJ Media.
I've seen the byline. I think.
I think he's got a series called Afterburner. And I think in one of the clips, he actually talks about the fact that, contrary sort of to popular, folk wisdom, so-called conservatives are actually, I mean, to use his words, more fun than sort of the typical.
Oh, we're so much more fun, mostly because we're better educated, you know, so we've got more things to draw on.
Okay. Please direct all hate mail to Milo.
No, I mean, look, we're better looking, you've got more money, and we're better educated, so of course we're more fun.
Here come the generalizations, go.
No,
I'm just saying, you know, it's just, if you, it stands to reason, if you've got less to worry about, you're going to, you know, you're going to develop the higher pleasures, right. Literature, music, art, philosophy, humour. You know, I mean, it's very obvious to me why conservatives would be naturally funnier than liberals.
I'm going to talk in a second about one group that you direct some generalizations at, so hold off for a second.
I'm happy to defend myself.
Let's talk about, I wanted to pass by you an idea that I'm actually, this is, I think, the first time that I talk about this publicly. One of my graduate students and I are looking at studying something that is at least relevant to your sort of personal history. We're looking at exploring the intersection between evolutionary psychology and consumer behavior, which is what I do, but specifically within the homosexual market. And so you might say, well, how do these things kind of relate? So one of the things that we're thinking of doing, and I just wanted to sort of get your first sort of reaction to it. So if you look at, say, the classic, you know, top-bottom dichotomy, right, in sexual relationships amongst men.
What are you about to ask me? I'm feeling...
No, hold on. So for example, there is a scientific study, and I actually wrote an article about it on my Psychology Today blog, looking at, so of course there are the versatiles, but then there are the heavily top, the heavily bottoms. And it turns out that, you know what was correlated to whether they were highly top or bottom in this particular study? Can you think of anything?
In terms of spending habits?
No. This is not about consumer behavior. This is unrelated. Oh, but
what are you? What sort of thing?
So it was actually penis size.
So if they're bigger, they're more likely to be tops.
Exactly.
So, yeah, I mean that's the reason, right?
Yeah, right. So anyway, so what we thought is to take this idea of top versus bottom, yes, and see whether if you identify yourself as predominantly being bottom or top, and now, yes, you're in a gay couple. Will, yes, some of the dynamics that happen in heterosexual coupling, for example, you go out on a date, yes, and, typically in terms of that courtship ritual, the man will pick up the tab. It doesn't matter how much.
Right? You're so absolutely right about this. You're more right than you realize.
Oh, beautiful. Is that a science paper right there?
Yes, it is. And I'll tell you, I'll give you some interesting insight here.
And nobody better steal that idea because we haven't published it yet.
Right. If you're watching, you can't have it. Exactly. I might write a column about it, but not until he's done his paper. Okay. So. Watch out. My hunch on this, based on my experience, is that the penis size thing is definitely true. But also, don't know what it says about me that I'm a bottom, but no. Sorry.
Maybe you're the outlier. Maybe you're the exception. You don't know.
I think I'm pretty average. I don't know. Okay. What I've observed is that at a time when heterosexuals are running away from traditional institutions like marriage and engaging, you know, you've got these stories about men having sex with other men, although they still identify as straight, the genderqueer, the trans, all of this kind of messiness among gender identities among heterosexuals, and them giving up on traditional traditional institutions like marriage. Gay communities are going in the opposite direction. The many, many gay relationships I know look like the stereotypical idyllic 1950s relationship where you have the top who goes out and earns the money, who works out, you know, and the bottom who looks after the home and who very often spends the money. There are a lot of gay relationships fall into that pattern.
And are you applying this only for male homosexual relationships, or you're applying this also for sort of the butch femme?
I don't believe in lesbians, so I don't really think, I don't spend much time.
You don't believe in lesbians?
I don't believe in lesbians. It's just unhappy women between relationships. I don't. No. Okay, there are a couple of butch dykes who are like lesbians for life. Okay. But all of the women that they have sex with, the pretty ones, are lesbians for a while. I mean, I'm just saying in a slightly blunter way what anybody, you know, anybody.
So you're talking about sexual fluidity. Okay.
Women have much more malleable fluid sexualities, and very few, very vanishingly few women. Tiny percent of women only have sex with women ever. You know, it just doesn't really happen. Whereas a perfectly respectable percentage of men only have sex with men, and most gay men have only had sex with men. Most self-identified lesbians have done both, and very often equal quantities of both. I don't really believe in lesbians. I think there's a tiny proportion of like butch bull dykes, but there aren't really any lesbians.
But so the women that couple together for 40 years.
It just means they've given up.
Oh, it's come just, on, like, man.
Look at lesbian bed death. You know, I've written about this. Okay, the two reasons you know that these people have basically just given up: lesbian domestic violence, lesbian obesity. Right, the two characteristics of lesbian relationships aren't anything to do with the roles that they take. Actually, there are three. Lesbian domestic violence epidemic. You'll never hear about it. Nobody wants to talk about it. I wrote an article very sensitively titled "Attack of the Killer Dykes," which was about this.
I'm getting a headache at the hate mail that's coming my way. Oh my god, I'm getting a migraine.
Tell me to behave on this podcast. I'm merely quoting the title of a piece of journalism. Okay, I called it "Attack of the Killer Dykes." It was about lesbian domestic violence. Nobody wants to talk about it. Lesbian bed death. Which is a phenomenon that describes the fact lesbians just don't have sex after the first couple of months, you know? A double-headed dildo gets no action after the first
family
month of this.
Family show!
Sorry, we can cut that bit out. What else was it? Anyway, I can't remember, there was a third one, but you know, there's lots of things suggest that that these sorts of lesbian relationships are actually just women giving up on relationships at all. They don't really want to have meaningful, engaging sexual relationships with another human being at all, so they form a sort of partnership with another woman. And lots of radical feminists will agree with this, by the way. You see second wave, trans exclusionary radical feminism, whether it's Jermaine Greer, Julie Bindle or whatever, they'll say, yeah, I just hate men. I'm a lesbian because I hate men. And they're perfectly happy saying that. And we accept it because they're women and because they're lesbians. Whereas, you know, of course, if as any other group, then that's not acceptable, because, of course, you're born gay, which you're not. That's a lie. That's just PR from the gay industry. Nobody's born gay. It's stupid. What a stupid idea.
Are you being serious now about the last time
that you were? I'm totally serious. It was invented by the gay
law. So you think your sexual orientation was a choice?
It's a mixture. It's a mixture. But I remember making a very conscious decision to bring home lots of drug dealers to annoy my mother. I remember distinctly that a choice component in my sexual identity. Very distinctly, very clearly, I remember this. And those people who think they were just born this way don't know better, or they're kidding themselves, or they're just lying. Born this way was an invention of the gay lobby in the 80s and 90s to get around the religious right, who used to say that homosexuality was an immoral lifestyle choice. So the gay lobby was like, God, what do we do? Well, I guess, yes, it is, according to your rules. I know, gay gene. We were born this way. We're just like women. We're in a press club. We're just like women or blacks. We were born this way, so you can't discriminate against us. How about that one, guys?
Can I interject?
That's literally what happened. I mean, everybody knows this is what happened. This is what GLAAD did. This is what all of the gay lobby organizations did in the 80s and 90s. And it's sort of stuck. There's no scientific basis whatsoever for this. And it's obviously a mixture. Some people buy into the epigenetic kind of hormonal womb thing. But it's obviously a mixture for everyone. And it's perhaps more or less of a mixture for some people. But to simply say that gays are born this way, at a bare minimum, there's no scientific basis for such a claim.
So I will have to respectfully disagree with the lack of scientific basis. I think both homosexual and sexual orientation is innate. Now, what's interesting about the gay lobby that you were talking about, and I actually briefly mentioned this in the first chapter of one of my books, The Consuming Instinct, the gay lobby will argue that being gay is you're born, which they're correct, and you contest that. Whereas they will argue that heterosexuality is an imposed norm, which is quite an extraordinary statement to make, right? You have a sexually reproducing species where somebody is arguing that homosexuality is innate, heterosexuality is an imposed heteronormative, right? So it is, yeah. I mean, you don't really have to be a sophisticated evolutionist. Right.
I hate gay people. This is, you know, what drives more homophobia in America today than anything else. It is like the gay establishment, not gay people. Nobody cares that much anymore about gay people. It is like it's the little progressive gay lobby that come out with lies and nonsense like this. They just make us all sound crazy. I mean, I'm so like, I feel so awkward and angry that I'm represented by these people who just say stuff like what you just described, and I'm just like, oh my god, I hope people don't think I think that. Yeah, it's awful.
So, but if you go back to your earliest, and then we'll leave this point, but I want to be on record in saying that I disagree with
you.
That's
fine. You can be wrong on record. That's okay.
But if you go back to your earliest sexual memory, not of you having sex, but in terms of being attracted to a target, yes, recognizing that you're attracted to Linda or to Bob, Would you say that your earliest memories were ones where the target of your sexual attraction were boys, or no, it was fluid, or
me,
what?
Me, it was a mixture.
It was a mixture, okay.
And I picked one.
Yeah. Okay, and what was the catalyst of you deciding that, despite the fact that it's not...
It would annoy my mother. I just knew it would annoy my mother. I bought him lots of black
dresses. So even today, as you couple with other men, you're not doing it because there is some innate...
Well, I think I'm in a rut now. I think it's sort of stuck. I tried, because, you know, I'm attracted to things that are naughty and transgressive, as you can tell from my journalism. But it all comes, really, from the fact that I like forbidden sex. And so I like, you know, sex with scary people and sort of... You know, I like to be quite powerless and all the rest of it. Let's not move on from that. But
oh, yeah.
let's save this for another day. We'll save this for
we'll save it for offline.
For hours. But the point I'm making is that now homosexuals are so mollycoddled and pandered to and so endlessly patronized in culture, my sex life has sort of become less interesting. Because I know that in the middle of it, my mother's not going to rush in and disapprove. This is why Catholics have the best sex, because all sex is somehow, you know, guilty.
Naughty, right?
As if, God, people are like, oh, Catholics, you're so screwed up about sex. Yes, that's the point. It's fantastic.
Do you speak French?
A little.
So there is, you know, sort of the classic stereotype of the very gentle, quiet Catholic girl. And there's an expression in French that says, méfie-toi de l'eau dormante. Beware of still water, right? So underneath this
this is when you go for like nice blonde peppy Californian like preppy rich girls. They're always broken and damaged and they want to do it, and I'll let you put it anyway. I'm totally down with that. I'm one of those girls. I've lost interest in sex slightly now that homosexuals are so endlessly mollycoddled. And I'm only half joking about this. I think it might be time. I wrote a column about this, so some people listening will have already heard this joke. But I wrote a column at the time a while ago, because I like transgressive sex, I like naughtiness, and I like, you know, being the forbidden. I'm very drawn to the forbidden. I was one of those personalities. I think I might have to go and join a new oppressed victimhood class so that my sex is forbidden again. I may have to become a straight white male. It's the only thing for it. It's the only group in society that is constantly...
That's all that's left.
Demonized and ridiculed. Your sexual impulses are constantly pathologized and ridiculed. Right. You're called creepy, racist. You know, any straight man who expresses any sort of sexual interest in a woman whatsoever is somehow at fault for something, somehow, in some way. I think I should go straight. It's the only way I'm going to get an erection again.
I want to get to the next topic, but I've remarked about this point in some form. I can't remember where. So, for example, if you look at being unattracted to, say, heavy women, right?
Yeah.
So then that typically you'll be accused of being a fatis, right? I mean, you're denying an opportunity of love and meaningfulness with a woman simply because of your disgusting norm of having learned that, you know, Beyonce is more attractive than somebody who weighs 800 pounds. Now, the opposite also holds true. If you are somebody who particularly is attracted to, say, women who are very heavy, you know what they will then argue, those women?
They're fetishizing them.
Exactly.
Yes,
so
yes.
So
I
it's perfect,
so
right? So
no,
if you
great.
Say...
Whatever happens, you're still wrong.
Right. All states of the world lead to oppression. If I don't like you because you're overweight, I'm a pig. If I like you because you're overweight, I'm a pig. There is no way I can't be a pig.
So I have a fairly social justice proof personality because I'm gay and I don't mind telling you about it, and because I like black guys and all the rest. You can't really get me on racism. You can't, because my dating history looks like...
Do I at all pass for the brown skin, or that's way too light?
I could be there. I have a daddy thing. You could totally go there.
All right, fair enough.
Because I like black guys and because, you know, I'm gay and yada, 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 they can't really get me on sexism. They can't really get me on homophobia. They can't get me on racism, which are their primary avenues. When they don't like what you're saying, they will seek to delegitimize you by attacking you rather than the argument,
sure,
as we discussed earlier in the conversation. So now they've come up with this new thing I've noticed, and they said, Well, you might never stop banging on about your, you know, sexual desires for darker skin, but of course all you're really doing is fetishizing the black experience. And
So it is racism. You are being racist.
No, so in fact, you're the worst kind of racist. Right. You are dehumanizing. Oh my God. You know, and I just, here's the thing about whether it's crazy video game critic feminists, or whether it's Black Lives Matter, or whether it's any one of these other sort of loony gender warriors, or, you know, grievance mongers, race hucksters, whoever it is, the reason they're losing, and 2016 is going to be the great glorious year of you know, popular revolution against social justice, and it's already happening, the reason they're losing is they've excluded more people than they've included by gradually calling everyone a name at some point. Because when you set the bar, what happens is when you set the bar so unrealistically and absurdly high that no one can make the grade, or that only 2% or 1% or 0.2% of the population can ever meet your standards, the majority will say, well, your standards are unattainable, so I'm just going to stop bothering. I'm just not going to bother trying. And what do they do when they're constantly told by, let's say, Democrat politicians that they're racist, sexist, that they are benefits of white, cishet, you know, male, patriarchal, blah, blah, blah? They say, you know what? I know I'm not a racist. I know I'm not a sexist. Screw you guys. I'm voting for Trump. You know, and that's the product. You know, Trump, and to a certain extent, me too. You know, we are the product of, in very different ways, we're very different figures. And I don't want to sort of say that we're identical in any way, but kind of are a little bit in some respects. And we are mostly because we are direct products of the progressive left. And I've got a naturally contrarian personality. If I was living under a great sort of religious dictatorship, I'd probably be left-wing because I believe more than any political position in free speech. Right. And in, you know, I'm, what is it? I'm Ian... whatever, I'm like the contrarian personality, you know, the debater. I love exposing people to different points of view and challenging them, making them think. As it happens, I'm on the right side of history because the incumbent power is the one that's got...
Oh, what happened
there? Oh, I don't know. Give me a second. Sorry.
All right. Sorry, guys. Okay, here we go. He's back.
Two terrible interruptions. I'm sorry. I'm the no worst worries. Behaved guest that he's ever going to have. So people in and out of my house all the time. What I love is free speech and free intellectual inquiry and open exchange of ideas and provoking humorless, earnest people who can't take jokes and who want to stop you from reading certain things and thinking about certain things. I love all of that, you know. And basically, I just find it. Sorry.
Well, there is, I think, a breath of fresh air, irreverence about you that, at least when I sort of first found out about you, you know, made me desirous to have a chat with you, because I respect people who don't succumb to all of these different forms of thought policing, right? I put out a tweet recently where I said, you know, I was remarking about the fact that, you know, in Hollywood, there are so few people who are not sort of part of the what would be called the regressive left and all those sort of progressives. And I mentioned Clint Eastwood. I mean, I sort of thought of the first guys that came to mind. So Clint Eastwood, James Woods, Rosanna Barr. I mean, she's no Einstein.
Rosanna Barr's great, isn't she?
And then there was a fourth one. I can't remember who the fourth one was. And then people started...
Adam Baldwin would be in there.
Yeah, and people started getting angry because, oh, why are you supporting this... My point was that they... Oh, it was John Voight, actually. The
Oh, yeah, I love him.
Angelina Jolie. And my point was that they had... All four of them had the testicular fortitude to simply stand up...
Very sexist metaphor.
The ovarian fortitude.
Whoever heard of such... No, let's take the testicular.
So, you know, my point was not that, you know, I've analyzed everything that Roseanne Barr said and I agree with it or disagree with it. It's simply the fact that she had the courage to speak out. And when, you know, when you're in academia, for example, you know, everybody is a sheep, right? And you have to act like a sheep. And precisely in the environment where you're supposed to be an open thinker and think outside the box. So I was remarking about their courage, and yet people got upset because suddenly I was a supporter of Rosanna Barr. Frankly, I don't really know her positions. But I want to get to the possibly the last topic, although of course I could keep you here for another 6 hours. I want to read to
you. Having so much fun. We should just keep it going forever.
Thank you so much. Yeah, can I tell you what is actually the only thing that stops me from going on forever? It takes me.
I might say dildo again.
No. I'm willing to bear that risk to go on. It's that it takes me forever to upload these damn things.
Oh, yeah, it does take a while.
Now,
yeah.
I don't know if it's...
You have many, many years ahead of many fruitful discussions on other subjects, so
lovely.
Don't worry.
You're lovely. I'm going to read you some really boring, idiotic, unaccomplished guys. Don't say who they are, and then let's see if we can identify any common threads about them.
Okay.
Here I've got a list of 54 of them. I won't read all 54, but I'll read a few that might tickle your fancy. So Niels Bohr, Francis Crick, James Watson... These are the co-discoverers of the double helix structure of DNA. Mm-hmm. Richard Feynman, Linus Pauling, Pavlov, John Nash. That's the guy who Russell Crowe played him, the economist. And
mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, right? Of course. Yeah.
Let me now skip a bit. Here are some other folks. Stephen Hawking, as you mentioned. Sigmund Freud, Alfred Kinsey.
Yes.
Steve Wozniak, the co-founder of Apple, Alan Turing, whom I'm sure you know who that is.
I do.
Not because he was gay and you're gay,
but
he's British and famous guy. B.F. Skinner, right? Skinnerian conditioning. Let me mention a few more. Albert Camus, Marquis de Sade, as somebody who loves some of the kinky stuff. Stephen Fry, Franz Kafka, Salman Rushdie, George Bernard Shaw, a few more. Bertrand Russell, Simone de Beauvoir, Karl Marx, Nietzsche, John Stuart Mill, Jean-Paul Sartre, Schopenhauer, and Spencer. Some real idiots, some real morons, some real schmucks, some real poorly dressed folks. Do you know what they have in common?
You're going to tell me they were all atheists.
Bingo! What a bunch of retards. What a bunch of morons, these 54 Nobel laureates. Please explain to us why all these morons are utterly wrong.
I thought we were going to end this on a high. We're not going to sort of like argue through the God delusion.
No, frankly, I don't even. I mean, you could give me an answer, but I just wanted to jokingly point to you that
I know. Yeah. Look, I don't necessarily think atheists are stupid. I just think they're wrong, And what I find entertaining about them very often is how thin-skinned they are. And, you know, in the court, and you've demonstrated it for me beautifully in this conversation by asking me, you know, perfectly friendly, interesting, you know, loose questions for the rest of it, but preparing a huge litany of examples for the last.
Oh, no, so I'm one of those thin-skinned atheists?
The one that obviously got to you, the one you really wanted to nail me on, so you did your homework, was the atheism question, which sort of demonstrates my point. My point being that very often atheists do suffer from a sort of extraordinary thin-skinned sort of protection, you know, sort of feeling of anxiety about their lack of belief. You know? And I think maybe it's got something to do with... Well, I sort of think that atheism is kind of a symptom of autism. You know, if you can't really relate to other human beings very well, you could be really smart and you can have all the logical stuff worked out and that's fine. But you can't really relate to other human beings, you don't, maybe it's sort of sociopathy, autism spectrum. How can you ever come to know, you know, sort of make those intuitive, faith-based, love-based leaps of logic that it required for religion? And understand God's love if you can't understand the love between other, you know, between other human beings. If you don't really get other people, how could you possibly get, you know, how could you fathom an intelligence that created the universe? And the coincidence of autism and atheism is incredibly high, by the way. They're basically codependent.
You're just making this stuff up now.
No, I'm not. You can know there's a study, and I'm going to send it to you.
Please do.
And it shows, and it's like a locked-on, it's only a correlation, but it's locked-on tight, you know, like atheism and autism is like, you know, they go hand in hand. Now, I'm not saying that one causes the other necessarily. I'm suggesting point of discussion that certain kinds of mind might be disposed towards.
So I'm basically, I'm a sufferer of Asperger's syndrome, basically. And I'm a high functioning autistic guy.
High functioning autist, and as a result, you've ended up deciding there's no God.
Very, very nice way to end today's conversation.
I thought we were going to end on a high note. I didn't realize we were going to take it there, but you did. You did. I have to confess, to give you credit, you in your list of idiots and schmucks, you did read out several of my heroes. So
that's why I chose them. By the
way, I know you did.
This autistic guy has Machiavellian intelligence, it turns out.
Yeah, well, he was an autistic atheist as well. Actually, maybe not. I don't know. I can't remember. No, I know exactly what you were doing. No, I mean, many of them, wonderful, brilliant, incredible people. Many of them found God later in life, by the way, or at least something to approximate. And there are plenty of great scientists who believe in God, and plenty of great mathematicians who come to be Christians the further they get into their careers. So, look, I mean, let's not play statistics with that, obviously. I think it's perfectly possible to be a brilliant, highly intelligent, articulate, and logical person and arrive at a logical way to as much as you can of faith and still decide that you want to take that leap and still believe in it. And I think it's also one thing that might interest you in the context of what we've been talking about is one of the things the progressive left does very often. They say, well, you're gay, how can you be a Catholic? Because they require this sort of pathetic, childish consistency that they don't demand of themselves when they're talking about their sort of gender fluidity or whatever, you know, but they'll demand it from you. And it profoundly misunderstands what the church is or Christianity is and homosexuality to say that these things are, you know, completely incompatible, and also ignores the simple fact that we all, as Eliot put it, contain multitudes, and we are all messy and complex, and we all have competing beliefs. You know, atheists may have decided, and may be happy that they've decided, they've resolved, you know, a particular conflict in their mind. But many of the other things they believe will be based just as on faith as, you know, the religion that they criticize. I think we can agree, at least, that that we are all messy and complicated. And none of us has the right to demand of another person that their interior lives is completely internally consistent according to your own belief system. What we can do, I think, is interrogate arguments. And what I think social justice is, so the reason it's so poisonous is that it draws attention back to the individual as a means to delegitimize an argument or a belief system or a point of view. When what I think, my belief is that we should approach and deconstruct and analyze arguments on their own terms, you know, on their own merits.
Maybe next time we'll talk about whether it is possible to be moral whilst being an atheist. Now, of course, I'm willing to bet that you think that without morality, we would all be running, decapitating puppies, and then raping them.
I think you could be an atheist and sort of be accidentally moral, you know.
So I'm only accidentally not going on raping pillages right now. Yeah, otherwise,
cultural inheritance, you know, all of your values have been shaped by the society in which you live, which is Judeo-Christian, and the fact that you're an atheist doesn't mean that you can cast off all of that socialization and all of course of your natural evolutionary instincts, which tell you that certain things aren't going to be in your best interests. So atheists can be accidentally moral, sure.
To be continued. Is there anything that I need to put, I mean, not that you're not notorious enough that you need my promotion, but is there anything that you'd like me, a project that you're working on that you'd like me to include in the descriptor?
People can follow me for as long as I'm still allowed to have a Twitter account. At twitter.com/Nero, like the emperor, who is awesome aside from the Christian burning. And other than that, my columns are at Breitbart, and it's been a pleasure. Thank you so
absolute
much.
Absolute pleasure. I'm going to stop it, but stay on the line. Thank you so much, Milo. Sure. This is really amazing.
Thank you. All right.